Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials and Libraries, Issues and Practices. The topic of this program is Living Bird, the member magazine of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. My guest is Tim Gallagher, editor-in-chief of Living Bird since 1990. Tim is also the author of the books The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-billed Woodpecker, and Falcon Fever, A Falconer in the 21st Century. Yes. Well, Tim, welcome to Periodical Radio. Living Bird is the member magazine of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Could you describe for us the mission of the lab?
It's actually an environmental group, and besides being part of Cornell University, it's a membership organization with about 30,000 members, and we basically are using birds to give people, you know, an entry into the natural world and get them interested in it and interested in helping to protect birds and other wildlife and habitats.
Where does Living Bird fit into the overall mission of the lab?
Well, it's a popular magazine. It's aimed at a popular audience, and so we're trying to attract a wide range of people, not just scientists, you know. And we're interested in citizen science, that is, regular people gathering data across the United States and Canada, you know, that we can use to determine whether birds or populations are, you know, which ones are in trouble and so forth.
So one of my questions was why a popular magazine instead of a scholarly journal, and you just pretty much answered that, but what's the origin of that focus of really reaching out to the public rather than reaching to other academics for the publication?
Well, you know, our founder, Arthur Allen, from the start, you know, he first started what's called the Lab of Ornithology in about 1915, although it was nothing like what it is now. It wasn't a membership organization or anything like that, but it was in the 1950s that it became more like it is now. But actually, the publication at first, when it came out in the early 1960s, it was more of a technical journal on ornithology, and it just came out once a year called The Living Bird. And, you know, we had a very limited membership at that time. You know, it was about 1,500 members. And there was a point in the early 1980s when Charles Walcott became the head of the lab. He just thought our work was important enough that he wanted to go out to more people, draw more people in, and, you know, people who, you know, might have more influence on things, you know. And so that's when it became a quarterly magazine, popular magazine.
Why the title Living Bird rather than something like Cornell Ornithology News?
That was actually suggested by Roger Torrey Peterson, the famous bird artist and author. He was on the Lab of Ornithology's board of directors at that point, you know, actually in the early 1960s. And, you know, he thought it was important to stress that living birds is what we're really interested in, you know, and to keep the common birds common and everything. You know, that was at a time when, you know, birds are being affected by DDT and other things in the environment, and it just was our emphasis was on, you know, keeping birds' populations healthy. And
I have a question about terminology. What's the difference between a birder and an ornithologist?
An ornithologist, I would say, you know, it used to be in the 19th century, people were called ornithologists, and they very often were amateurs, but they were people who went out in the field and, you know, studied birds and perhaps collected eggs and bird specimens and so forth. But, you know, now it's more a person who's gone through, they're a professional, you know, they've gone through a university and gotten a PhD usually, and they're, you know, they're scientists. And birders, there's more of a hobby, although many of them are real serious and everything. It's more of a hobbyist. It's someone trying to see as many birds as possible, bird species, and to learn how to be really expert at identifying them. But there's a lot of crossover.
Mm-hmm. Why do people have a special fascination with birds?
Well, they're such charismatic animals, and everywhere you go in the world, birds are there. And they, in a way, I mean, you could take a birder and almost drop them anywhere in the world, and if they're familiar with the bird songs, and that's part of the distinctive nature of every place you go. It's a different avifauna. You know, there'd be different bird songs you hear and different birds that you see. And, you know, to me, it's just enriched my life. I can't imagine not being as focused on them as they are, because they're also colorful and the songs are beautiful that they sing.
Richard Love coined the term nature deficit disorder to describe how today's kids spend too little time exploring nature. In your view, is birding one of the better antidotes to nature deficit disorder?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I certainly, I have young children, you know, and it's certainly been great getting them involved in learning about birds and taking them on hikes in the woods and things like that. And it's really enriched their lives. I do worry about a lot of children now who just grow up playing video games or doing stuff on the computer or watching television. And they're really losing out. That's nothing like the way I grew up. When I was young, my friends and I, we'd just run wild all day, run through the woods, and, you know, everything was so interesting and mysterious, and I just wanted to learn more and more about it. And there's not as much of that anymore. So it's, I hope we can do things to counteract that.
Does the Ornithology Lab have special outreach for young people?
Yeah.
Is that a real target audience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. We have a whole curriculum that we, you know, give to elementary schools, or actually K through 12, bird study curriculum. Go ahead.
Is it possible to become a birder without also becoming a conservationist?
I think that if you learn about wild birds like that, and then you see how their numbers are declining. I mean, some of your favorite birds, when you see, oh, these birds are declining 5% a year and have been for the last 20 years, that's pretty scary. And so, yeah, I think definitely most birders are conservationists.
And as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, that is a major focus of the Living Bird magazine, right?
Mm-hmm.
The conservation angle.
That's right. Personally, to me, when I've been here for 18 years now, and when I came here, that was one reason. I came because I wanted to do some good for conservation, and I've steadily pushed this publication, to help with conservation. You know, not necessarily like an advocacy group attacking certain things, but writing about studies where we and other people are doing that are showing what's happening with birds and why they're in danger and why we need to, try to help their populations.
The Ornithology Lab promotes citizen science, something else you've already mentioned. What are some things people can do to contribute to the science at the lab?
Well, we have a whole slew of citizen science projects, ranging from ones that are really easy to do, like there's Project Feeder Watch, which we have something like 15,000 people involved in that, and they just record the species and numbers of birds that come to their bird feeders, there are other ones that are more in-depth, birds in forested landscapes, where they'll let you go out we used to have Project Tanager, where you'd go out with recordings and play them and see if, tanagers responded. And, they were really more in depth in trying to find their nests and everything. And we've got ones that involve birdhouses, the Birdhouse Network, you know, actually going in and counting the numbers of young yeggs and young in bluebird and tree swallow nests boxes, and you know, whether they're successful or not. So we've got a lot, and it's actually really amazing the amount of data we get in from these from our citizen scientists, and it's really valid data. You know, there are always some people who maybe don't know enough, but we've got filters to be able to find if something's probably not accurate. But you know, for example, house finches. Several years ago, a lot of house finches were getting an eye disease, and it seemed to be spreading across the east. And we asked all our feeder watchers. You know, we formed a new program to study this house finch eye disease, and we've been able to map the spread of it, you know, all across the east and even to the west now, and in a way that, you know, no one's been able to track the spread of a wildlife disease like that before, and it's really interesting data.
So the data with the citizen science programs are well respected within the professional ornithology field?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, there have been numerous scientific papers made just based on this data. And, you know, people were skeptical at first, but they're not now. It's very valid data.
That's wonderful. One of the things I've noticed in the printed magazine Living Bird is the photography is really exceptional. Who are your photographers, and what are you looking for in the images that are published in the magazine?
Well, you know, we have a lot of the top wildlife photographers in the country. You know, people like Arthur Morris and Mari Reed we have Franz Lanting's done some photo essays before, and a lot of other very well-known people. But you know, I look at stuff from other people too. They're up-and-coming photographers who send me samples of their work, and I look at it, and if it's good, I'll send them our list. So you know, we always, every issue we have a list of our photo needs that we send out, and I go through them with the designer, and we just figure out which are going to be the best pictures to use. And yeah, since we're dealing with birds, which the visual presentation is everything. You know, people want to look at beautiful pictures of birds, so we get the best pictures and design them in a pleasing way. And we also have some of the best reproduction quality I've seen in a magazine. You know, so we actually use a sheet-fed press and everything. So
that pre-production process has certainly changed over the years, hasn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've been around long enough to remember, you know, taking physical manuscripts over to a typesetter and then having to paste up the magazine, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the last day, you're making fixes with X-Acto knives cutting letters. So that's been interesting. Now we do it all on the computer. It's pretty
sure.
Easy.
A few years ago, I spoke with Elizabeth Folwell, who's the art director at Adirondack Life, and she went into some detail about how much things have changed over the years. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
With all of the information the Ornithology Lab puts up on your website, why continue having a printed magazine?
Well, I think a significant number of our members still want to get a physical magazine. You know, it. I don't know how it'll be in 10 or 15 years. I mean, a lot of younger people are more used to seeing things online. And, you know, but the way it is right now, I mean, we do surveys about things like that, and people love getting Living Bird, and they like having it out on their coffee table for people to look at. And so, you know, probably for the rest of my career, we'll still be putting out a physical magazine. But I think we have a really nice website now, too, of course, livingbird.org, and you know, it captures a lot of what the issue looks like, and has extra multimedia features and all that. But I still see it like as something, just an added bonus. I still think people want to get the magazine. You know, probably 80% of our people.
That's a similar response I've heard from, like, New York State conservationists, that people just enjoy getting the printed version. Tim, what aspects of your job as editor do you personally find most enjoyable?
Well, that's interesting, because I'm a person who, in some ways, who could have become a scientist. I was working as a teenager, helping with bird counts for the California Department of Fish and Game, like falcons, prairie falcons, peregrine falcons, and things like that. And I think the reason I didn't go that route was because I really didn't like the type of writing that was in technical journals, really dry kind of writing, because that's not the way I felt about these animals I was studying. So I got into journalism, got a magazine journalism degree, and then a master's degree in English. But I still liked the scientific life, and I started traveling with scientists and working with them, going on expeditions, which I still do. So that's what I really love the best about my work. I've done stuff like gone to Greenland a couple of times on expeditions and an open boat up the coast, looking at deer falcon nests and dovekie colonies and things like that. And I've gone across Iceland and, lots of northern Alaska, Africa. And I've gotten to spend time with people who are really passionate about their work and the animals they're studying. And I get right into it. I'm a good field worker, a field biologist. And so, I get to do that, but unlike people like that who will spend 30 years studying one species, I get to do it for 3 weeks and then come back and write about it and then do something else next time. So I have a lot of interest in my life and it's sort of, it makes it like a rich experience for me.
What parts of the job are most challenging?
I'm probably not the type who likes to work on budgets and things like that, and to have meetings. I don't like to have lots of meetings. I'm more someone who I like to be, and even just being in an office 9 to 5, like I am a lot of times. That's not the kind of thing I love to do. Although, my office, I have a beautiful view of the woods outside, the nice autumn leaves, so that's nice, and I can duck out and go hiking through the woods and go bird watching, But I like the more outdoor things, basically, than compared to like being in an office and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, being an editor, that's part of my job.
Sure.
Being in an office, supervising people, and doing budgets.
Is keeping it on track, on schedule, a major challenge? Living Bird is quarterly, correct?
Yes.
Is that tough to get it out every quarter?
No, not really. You get a rhythm to it. I've worked for a monthly magazine. I've worked for a daily newspaper, so it's not like deadlines really. I don't have a problem with deadlines. I'm really good at getting things done, and I sort of just kind of intuitively know when things need to be done. I don't have like a rigid. I don't put myself through a rigid schedule. It's more intuitive.
Do you recruit the writers for the articles primarily, or do you get a significant number of articles that are just sent in over the transom and that just come to you? What's the mix there?
Well, I do it every which way. I constantly, I'll get an idea or I'll see something. I might see someone give a talk and think that would be a really good article, or someone might do a scientific paper and I think that would be good. And if I don't think that scientist can write it for a popular audience himself, I might think of someone else who could write that. But I get a lot over the transom. But they're not all, you get a lot that aren't as good, a lot of chaff there. And I write quite a few myself, and I'll get other people around the lab to write sometimes, and I do have a number of freelance writers whose work I really like. Who, you know, I'll give them an assignment sometimes. I'll call them up out of the blue sometimes and see what they think of this.
Tim, the summer 2005 issue of Living Bird includes the story of the rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker, which, of course, you played a major role in. And you wrote a book about the rediscovery of the grail bird. What messages would you like people to take away from your experience of the ivory-billed woodpecker?
Well, yeah, partly not to give up. You know, there's been a tendency, you know, people in 1910 were saying the ivory bill is probably extinct, and yet people would run across them. And you know, I think when I started working on that book, I went around and started interviewing people. I started with people who'd seen them in the 1930s and early 40s in the old Singer track. But I also found many people much later, hunters and fishermen, who said they'd seen them and had good descriptions and seemed to be honest. And I tried to keep an open mind and, you know, really listen to what they're saying and check it out and go to the places where they said they saw birds. And that's what led to that sighting. So I found one person who had a good description from just, you know, 6 days earlier. At this point, I don't know, you know, we're still searching for some of these birds that are nesting, and we haven't been able to find a nest yet, or even a reliable bird that you can always find in a certain place. You know, we had a lot of sightings in, for a month or two after, you know, we had that sighting in 2004, but it's sort of, there's not much going on in Arkansas right now, and we've moved to other places. But I'd say the lesson is, you know, just to not give up, and also the importance of saving habitats.
That's because, what I wanted, you know, to ask about. Could describe, I don't think everybody who might be listening to this program is aware of what the habitat is. Can you describe what the habitat was and what's happened to it?
Well, it was bottomland swamp forest, and with huge cypress trees and really wild country. This was, you know, at the end of the Civil War, this kind of country was all across the river drainages of the southern United States, and, you know, filled with wolves and panthers and bears, and just an amazing, amazing place. But, you know, then they started, a lot of northern companies came in after the war and were able to buy up the logging rights and just started cutting those trees down and, you know, shipping the wood back up to rebuild Chicago after the fire and places like that. But, you know, it just devastated that whole habitat. And in the 1930s, when they found the trees in the Singer tract, which is an 81,000 acre tract of virgin timber in northeastern Louisiana, and it had ivory bills, and it had more wolves than anywhere in the lower 48 states, and just an amazing, amazing place. And there was a huge fight trying to save it, but the logging company cut it down in the early 1940s. And that was the last really huge chunk of that kind of habitat left. And now, you know, it's starting to grow up again. There are places that haven't been cut in over 100 years. And, of course, it'll take 400 or 500 years for it to look like it did when it was virgin timber. But, you know, we've got to start moving in that direction. We've got to save a lot of that habitat and not let special places like that disappear again. We should have learned our lesson by now.
Are things better now? Or are you encouraged?
Well,
in terms of saving really precious resources?
Well, yeah. You know, in the 1940s, there weren't any environmental laws. You know, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt didn't want the Singer tract to get cut down, but he didn't have any law he could point to and put a stop to it. The governors of four states put up money trying to buy the logging rights so the trees wouldn't be cut, but it happened anyway. But now we do have strong laws. And although people keep tampering with the Endangered Species Act and trying to weaken it, it's still pretty strong. So I'm more hopeful. And actually, you know, the habitat in the southern swamps is much better than it was in the 1950s when it was about at its worst condition. You know, so much of it had been clear cut and everything, and now it's really growing back a lot. And I'm hoping that we won't just get into some other, you know, another wave of cutting or something as it matures.
Tim, is there anything we haven't addressed in our interview that you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, just that, you know, I think the life of a journalist or a magazine editor is a good career. It's been good for me. I've enjoyed it. I've done a lot of interesting things, traveled all over the world, and, you know, I'd recommend it.
Very good. Well, Tim Gallagher, thank you very much for being my guest.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Memberships to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology start at $40 and include Living Bird. To subscribe, visit www.livingbird.org. Thank you for listening to Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.